I'm Kate Remington with Steve Hackman. He'll be guest conducting the Stanford Symphony Orchestra concerts this Saturday and Sunday at the Palace Stanford, and it's great to have a chance to talk with you.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
You know, your career has taken you all over the country and all over the world, and yet this is the first time you've conducted the Stanford Symphony. So what are you especially looking forward to being on the podium and conducting them?
Well, there's a fantastic group of musicians. I was lucky enough to be in town in New York when they played their previous concert, which I believe was their opening concert of the season, with their brand new music director, Michael Stern, who is an old friend of mine and was a mentor of mine as a conductor when I was a student at Aspen. So it was a celebration in many ways for me to see him conduct again and then, of course, experience the magnificent orchestra at the Stanford Symphony. I mean, as you well know, this is the quality of that orchestra is just fantastic. So I was, sitting there listening to them play the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony and just very joyfully anticipating the time when I'd be able to make music with them.
Yeah, one of their previous music director described this orchestra as his like Ferrari, because he can really just like open the throttle and it seems like they can play anything. So I think you'll have a lot of fun with them.
Oh, definitely. That's an often used sort of metaphor for a truly world-class orchestra that knows how to play cohesively and that is elegant and luxurious, because, you know, a Ferrari it has power, but it can move so subtly. And so I think, it's amazing to feel that with an orchestra.
Yeah, I can imagine. The works that you'll be conducting are really varied and just, you know, really genuine crowd pleasers that have withstood the test of time. The Overture to the Magic Flute by Mozart, Dvorak's Symphony No. 7, and then Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez with guitar soloist Thomas Flippin, who is just an amazing virtuoso. So let's just start there. Let's start with the Rodrigo. Is this a piece that you have a long history with?
Well, I've known it for a long time. My father is an amateur classical guitarist. So, I know a lot of the guitar repertoire from, you know, I have these kind of moments of reminiscence walking past the room that he would practice in and just, you know, hearing little snippets of things here and there. So, but this, of course, is also just a very, very well-known and famous piece that if you're a classical musician, you're going to encounter inevitably. So, I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. I mean, it is crowd-pleasing, you know, so sometimes sometimes I don't like to use that term because that would somehow imply that it's not musically substantial, you know, but in this case, it very much is. And it's just beautiful melodies, so evocative. And it's incredible that this composer, at really an extremely difficult time in his life, was able to put out this extraordinary music.
Yeah, and it's also remarkable because Rodrigo was blind, and his primary instrument was the piano, so he didn't even really know the guitar. I mean, obviously, he came to know the guitar, and those are the pieces that he's remembered for now, but he wasn't a guitarist, and so for him to be able to create this amazing picture with the guitar is just really incredible.
It's pretty stunning. A little backstory on that, he had, I believe he was on his honeymoon. And so they were wandering through these gardens, as you said, Aranjuez, and he obviously was just taken by the fragrance of the flowers and the gushing of the fountains, et cetera. But it wasn't until years later when, you know, him and his wife were broke in Paris and cold and the world was about to go to war, and they even they lost a child, and then he wrote this music, and there is a happy ending to the story because, of course, the music made him extraordinarily famous, and it was lucrative for him, but also it was premiered around the time of the birth of their first child. So it is, those are just amazing things to think about when hearing this beautiful music.
Yeah, and he did so much. I mean, obviously, his hearing was just so incredibly attentive and finely tuned, and he put so much of the sounds that he heard in those gardens into his music. I mean, there's some really wonderful tone painting with birds and the fountains and just, you know, the colors that he gets, which is just really remarkable.
Absolutely. And that gives, you know, of course, a soloist, you know, first and foremost, so much room to play and interpret. So I cannot wait, you know, to hear what Thomas does with it.
Yeah, well, it's got to be a challenge balancing the quiet sound of the guitar against an orchestra really of any size. So how do you accommodate that? How do you keep the orchestra from drowning out the guitar?
Well, when an orchestra is in a concerto situation, they know that object number one is to make sure the soloist can be heard and can shine, and we put the soloist in a situation for success. So every orchestral player knows that, you know, that's our main objective. So now it's scored for a smaller orchestra. We'll have a reduced string count for it, I'm sure. And, balance is number one when you've got a when you have a concerto situation. So I'll rely on all of us using our ears on stage to make sure we're not playing too much. And then, of course, a set of ears out in the hall to make sure the balance is okay.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, the piece that opens the concert, the Overture to the Magic Flute, is such a great compliment because that there's such a delicacy to Mozart's writing in the Magic Flute, but also especially in the Overture, which is, you know, kind of like a little microcosm of all of the wonderful themes. And so that's a really great choice, and it's a really great way to open the concert too.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was told that this is the first time the Stanford Symphony has ever played the Overture of the Magic Flute, which is kind of unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I'm sure all these musicians have played it numerous times throughout their career, but kind of fun that it's a premiere for that orchestra. And I agree. I mean, it's a fantastic opening to any concert. It's an explosion of creativity, that opera. It's one of these, you know, works that sort of changed music, certainly changed opera. And counterpoint is one of my great loves, and I'm sort of obsessed with that. And in all these pieces, there's such rich counterpoint, especially, of course, in the Mozart Overture that has that fugue, you know, that opens the piece, or after the large grand statement at the beginning. So I can't wait to dive into that with these musicians again.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun. And then the biggest work on the program is the Dvorak Seventh Symphony that he wrote as a commission for an orchestra in London, and yet it's filled with so many references and love of Czech culture and Czech folklore. And I think what's so interesting is that in his time, he was really kind of criticized and almost even sort of looked down on for being this really provincial composer. And yet he really felt it was important to give the music of his country like a really amazing platform and forum in his works.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, this is an extraordinary work, and yes, you correctly mentioned that the Philharmonic Society in London had commissioned him to write the work. So he was over there conducting concerts, and then they gave him a commission to write a symphony for them, which was he was overjoyed about. And at this point in time, Brahms had become a champion of his. And, you know, so his career was starting to move from sort of provincial, from local, you know, to international. And he was dealing with, okay, how do I rectify this? How do I stay true to who I am, you know, as kind of stay true to my own nationalist voice, but yet develop and cultivate an international sound in my music, which would mean, you know, probably composing operas with German text and really kind of adopting a more kind of Austro-German style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty amazing what he did in this work, because I just think he succeeded on all fronts. He delivered an extraordinary work to the Philharmonic Society in London. I think he conducted the premiere there. He stayed true to his national style, but then he so elegantly and masterfully uses the techniques of Schubert and Brahms and Schumann and Beethoven in this symphonic form. So, it's an unbelievable work.
Yeah, it's just it's easy to listen to. And again, you know, you mentioned the phrase of a crowd pleaser, maybe necessarily indicating that there's not a lot of substance there. But I think what has made Dvorak be such a long-lived and beloved composer even now is that he does write melodies that are really accessible. And it's easy to understand. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you feel like you could just get up and dance to some of those inner movements. And I think a large part of that is because he was using the music from, you know, Bohemia that he knew so well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, the sometimes the great masterful works of art are so beautiful in their simplicity, you know, but yet underlying is such skill and technique. And in studying this work, the structure of it and the composition of it really is just so highly refined. In those melodies that you refer to are able to shine through, but they have such undercurrents of counterpoints and of complexities and of detailed part writing and of rhythmic layering that it's to study it and go in, it's stunning actually to see. You know, the result is so effortless, but yet you kind of look under the hood and you're just amazed at what he did with this. There's brevity here too. I mean, this is a 35-minute work, and that's to me one of the an equally stunning note about this piece, that it's so short, but yet says so much. I mean, I think if you ask anybody that, you know, isn't studying or playing the piece, how long do you think Dvorak's Seventh Symphony? They'd say, oh, it's 50 minutes. You know, it's like, oh, it's about length of a Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony or a Beethoven Eroica, but yet it's 35 minutes long. It's unbelievable.
Well, it must have been unbelievable at the time too, because the norm was 45 or 50 minute symphonies. So it's really amazing that he was able to be so economical and kind of tightly controlled and edited to get just exactly what he wanted to say out there. Well, you have this really interesting project kind of picking up and showing the parallels and the contrasts between bands that we know and singers that we know these days and classical composers like Brahms versus Radiohead or Bartok versus Bjork. And how did that project come together? What was the inspiration for that project?
Well, it's really just a reflection of who I've always been as a musician. It's interesting. Studying this Dvorak Seventh Symphony takes me so powerfully back to my days at the Curtis Institute of Music, because this is a piece that my conducting teacher just absolutely loved. I think we might have studied it with him twice when we were there, because he just loved to go back to it. So I can just remember the sessions at his apartment where we did score study sessions. The reason I bring that up is because I was studying those scores and conducting those pieces at Curtis, by day, but by night, quote unquote, I was always writing songs and producing albums and playing in bands. And I was just equally obsessed with popular music as I was with classical. And I hid it when I was at Curtis, and I didn't tell anybody because I was scared of being kicked out of school, frankly.
Wow.
That's not hyperbole. That could have very well happened. But once I entered sort of the professional world and conducting, I just, I really felt compelled to do something that honored both sides of my musicianship and that seemed unique to who I was. I think that's just like we're talking about Dvorak, trying to find that perfect balance between who he was inside and the music that was in his blood and in his bones, but yet, adopting the style of people he admired, like Brahms and Wagner and Beethoven. So that's that's what this is for me. It's trying to find that unique voice and that balance.
Well, do you find that listening to, say, Radiohead and Brahms kind of simultaneously, does that inform how you approach conducting, say, a Brahms symphony, or do you kind of keep them separate? Or where's the overlap if there was a Venn diagram with Brahms in one circle and Radiohead in the other circle?
Well, so firstly, the more that I've studied music on both sides, and the deeper my understanding has become, the more similar they reveal themselves to be. And again, this is something that I was already feeling when I was a student. But, you know, fast forward now to, you know, many, many concerts later and many albums produced later, it becomes truer and truer to me that how similar this music is. Now, they have different rituals of experience. They have different realizations as far as instruments and all these things. Of course, there are contrasts, but when you distill them down, it's the same mechanisms used to produce the music. So the overlaps are everywhere. It's just stripping away, again, those trappings that make them seem so dissimilar to us. That's what you need to do, and then you start to see how similar they are. And of course, what you also need to do is just kind of try to abandon that preconception so many of us have about genre and about labels and about one thing being different from the other.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like what I think it was Duke Ellington said, man, if it sounds good, it is good. And so I think it's really cool that there are fewer silos now from, you know, to put music in, because it's all just, yeah, there's so much like cross-pollination and pieces from different genres being played, you know, side by side and stuff. And I think that's kind of how everybody's playlists on their phones are these days. I mean, just kind of a little bit of everything.
I think that's a great point. I think playlists and accessibility, though there have been, I think, you know, some negative ramifications of that, they have kind of broken down the barriers quite a bit, because, you know, you search for the Dvorak 7th Symphony just the same way as you search for Dave Matthews Band on Spotify. You know, whereas at one point in time, you had to go to a different section of the record shop, or you might have just seen a record and think, no, this is my parents' stuff. No way. Like, you know, I go here. And, you know, you would have had to take out that CD and put it in, or take out that tape or whatever, or listen to that other radio station that you just never would tune into. And now it's just all kind of there. So if you hear something that, you know, kind of piques your interest in a movie, whether it's classical or hip hop or anything, you just go to Spotify, type it in, and start listening to it.
Yeah, it's an amazing, and the playlists that people put together are really, really fascinating, because you get to hear what other people find interesting, and then you discover new stuff. And so, yeah, it's really great. So, anything else that you'd like people to know about the concerts this weekend?
The Dvorak Symphony, just kind of another thing I want to mention about it is you hear so much how he was influenced by people like Schubert and Brahms and Beethoven and Wagner especially. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think of that, you know, Wagner's Tristan was 20 years before this symphony, but that's just another sort of another topic for conversation. But then you also hear how people like Mahler that came after him were influenced by this symphony. So I think there are three very, very influential and just truly inspired works on the program. I think that's how I would describe it. So now I just can't wait to bring the music to Stanford.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Steve, it's been really fun talking with you, and I know the concerts are going to be just a whole lot of fun and really enjoyable. So thank you so much for taking some time to talk about it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure.